Burgers are one of the most popular foods in America. You've probably eaten one recently, and you're definitely craving one now that we're talking about it. Make this summer one to remember with Good Ranchers. Right now, listeners will get free Wagyu burgers for a year. If you haven't had their American Wagyu burgers, I was just telling people here in the office, you're definitely missing out. My mouth is watering just thinking about it. Simply go to GoodRanchers.com and subscribe to any of their custom curated boxes filled with 100% American beef, chicken, pork, or wild caught seafood. Use code DAILYWIRE at checkout to claim your free American Wagyu burgers for a year. Not only is this a $400 value, but you'll also get a free bacon butter gift that's the perfect bacon topping for any burger. And in case you needed any other reason to support Good Ranchers, they support Paralyzed Veterans of America. Every order you make saves American farms and directly supports American veterans. Change the way you buy your meat today. Go to GoodRanchers.com and use code DAILYWIRE to claim your free burgers for a year and support veterans this Memorial Day season. That's GoodRanchers.com. Use code DAILYWIRE. Good Ranchers, American meat delivered.
So there's a book that's been around for a little while, but it's actually an idea that's kind of seeping into the culture, because a lot of people have been asking me about this now. It's a book called The Velvet Rope Economy, How Inequality Became Big Business. It's by Nelson D. Schwartz. He has more than 25 years experience as a business journalist at Fortune and The New York Times, covering everything from energy and economics to inequality in America and business in Europe. He now works as a communications and strategy consultant. Welcome, Nelson D. Schwartz. Thank you for coming on.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me and discussing one of my favorite topics.
Yeah. Well, let's start with the title. What is the Velvet Rope Economy?
The Velvet Rope Economy is this idea that there's tiering everywhere and kind of a new sort of caste system emerging in American society for us as consumers. So that could be 9 different lines to board a plane. It could be paying to skip the line at Disney. It could be a separate entrance at the ballpark or the football game. It could be seeing a concierge doctor that enables you to skip the wait for a specialist. It could be kind of a fast lane for your for college admissions, which everyone thinks of as, you know, somewhat meritocratic. I mean, you know, I think there's been some even criminal cases with college admissions, you know, just as I was finishing the book. But all of these areas that at least there was a pretension to fairness, or at least you know, you might get better service if you paid more, but everyone would be treated decently. That began to kind of break down, and we got this emergence of what I call a velvet rope economy, where some people are waiting behind the velvet rope and some are flying by.
When do you see this as having begun? When did this start happening?
You know, in fairness, some people said to me, well, hasn't it always been this way?
Well, that is a good question,
but, yeah. You know, but the truth is, you know, obviously, you know, first and second class and third class existed on the Titanic more than 100 years ago. And, you know, the rich in, you know, in the Great Depression, you know, in the movies, were living lives like in the clouds. And, you know, so obviously class differences aren't new. But I think, you know, beginning in the 1980s, there was a greater comfort with segregating consumers. And you began to see sort of much more defined groupings and barriers. I mean, when I went to Six Flags in New Jersey as a kid in the 1980s, everyone waited on the line. And now you can pay and go right to the front. And even if you watch The Love Boat, basically some people had bigger rooms than others on the boat, or, you know, portholes, but everybody kind of interacted together on cruise ships in the 60s and 70s. Now you have ships within a ship on the big cruise lines. You have areas where if you don't have a gold card, you can't go. And, you know, that's new. And same with ball games at Yankee Stadium. I write about this in the book. When I went with my grandfather as a kid in the Bronx in the 70s or 80s, you could walk down to the field to get autographs from the players before the game or after the game. You can't do that now. There's the legends section at Yankee Stadium, and the access to the field is only for elite ticket holders. So those are all new examples. And I think it began sort of in the 80s, and technology, which we can talk about, has only made it easier to kind of segregate and tier markets, as consumer types like to say.
You say inequality became big business. The idea, I guess, is that this is a way that you can give people something for their money to get more money. Is that the basic
idea? Yes. I mean, the margins are better, and a lot of the growth has occurred in people who have money to spend, and people with more disposable income, by definition, have more money to spend. And that's where a lot of the growth has been in the economy, you know, at the high end. And you see that in the market for luxury goods, in the market for luxury homes, you know, just in sort of people who are, you know, dependent, you know, on the stock market for big, you know, gains in wealth. They've got the money in this economy, and companies want to go after that. And segregating their markets and tiering their markets is the way to do it.
So, you know, as you said, people are going to say, well, the rich have always been rich and the poor have always been poor. And there's always been this kind of separation. What's the problem? Why is this a problem, or is it a problem?
Well, you know, the book is not a Bernie Sanders kind of like screed against capitalism. You know, I'm not against capitalism. And I actually, you know, what made the book better is that a lot of companies kind of opened up to me, and they, you know, sort of how they thread the needle and how they walk the balance. And companies are sensitive to providing a decent experience to everyone, and maybe a sort of a richer experience to some, whilst making sure it's still reasonable for everyone. And, you know, that's something I write about. I think the issue is, for us as a society, when we don't come into contact with one another, and we're so, you know, segregated from one another by class, and we don't have shared experiences like all going to a baseball game or all playing for the sports team in our public schools. You know, now there are a lot of these travel teams or club teams, which are private for certain sports, that, you know, it's not like everybody in the town gathers on Friday night for the football game. And, you know, you lose these common experiences, or, you know, you don't even come into contact with the people who, you know, board the plane before you. And you're so mad by the time you get on, you're like the eighth or ninth group to board, and there's no room for your luggage. I feel like that contributes to some of the divisiveness and partisanship and just, you know, venom in our public dialogue and debate. So, you know, I feel like it's a loss when there aren't more shared experiences. That's my concern.
You know, it's a funny thing. I mean, this is a conservative site, and on the right, people have this kind of a dual feeling about things like this, because on the one hand, we're kind of sick and tired of elites, you know, basically setting the agenda. The idea of guys from the World Economic Forum flying around on private jets to tell us how much gas we can put in our Toyotas really sticks in our craw. But at the same time, every time we hear words like inequality, we immediately think the government is coming after our paycheck. We immediately think the government is going to seize on inequality and seize on anger to take more control of the economy. Is that what you're looking for, or do you have some other approach?
No. I mean, I do think, you know, government investment in certain areas like, you know, aid for education, you know, infrastructure, you know, would help some of these issues. But, you know, even look, I went to the University of Chicago, which is sort of a undergrad, not for economics, but is a bastion of conservative economic thinking. And, you know, even for conservatives, there are issues of how capitalism and unfettered capitalism affects traditions and affects sort of how we live and the sort of society. And I think even conservatives worry that, you know, if we don't have a sense of, you know, common things in the commonweal, something's lost, and that fairness and the perception that everyone has a fair shot is important for a functioning society. I think conservatives get that, you know, as well as liberals.
So. No, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. And obviously, you know, if you have too much inequality and it's too flagrant, that causes anger on both sides. You talk in the book about how this makes socialism appealing to people, that people think that socialism is going to even things out. I'm always interested in the fact that all of the socialists who are in government are supported by some of the richest corporations in the country. I'm not sure you can illuminate why that happens, but I'm interested in why why socialism becomes appealing to people and why corporations basically sign on to that.
Well, I don't know if corporations are signing on to socialism. I think, you know, when there's a sense that the playing field isn't level and you don't have a fair shot at things you're supposed to have a fair shot, like healthcare. Right. I mean, if you have one of these concierge docs and you get to see the heart surgeon and I have these examples in my book. If you get to see the cardiologist in 2 days and other people are waiting 2 months, or, you know, the oncologist or, you know, these kind of specialists, I think that really offends people's basic sense of fairness. Mm. Same. And, you know, even the college or the high school sports things or the college admissions, these are, you know, conservatives sort of see these kind of traditions and activities and kind of social bonds. You know, social bonds are, you know, important in a functioning democracy. You know, I studied Russian history in college, and you don't want a situation like, you know, before the Russian Revolution, where the elites and the ruling classes had no legitimacy. And I think we run this risk if the elites in our country and the wealthy are so cut off and they're kind of in the fast lane, that it runs a real risk of the rest of the population kind of being embittered.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it can just go too far. Has COVID, this book came out just before COVID or just as COVID was spread, has that made it worse or better?
You know, I think it's kind of made it worse. Yeah. You know, there were cases where people used connections to get shots ahead of the rest. But I think it's an issue because if you are a knowledge worker, a white collar worker, you know, upper middle class, you can just take your laptop and work from home and, you know, abandon the city, move to the country, you know, all that kind of thing. If you're a working class person, you're a truck driver, you're a restaurant worker, you know, you're in a customer service facing position, you can't do that. You have to show up at work. So you are at risk. And I think, you know, a lot of the restrictions on activity fell harder on working class people because, you know, they didn't have the option of, you know, working remotely.
What about, you know, one of the things that you say this starts vaguely in the 80s. The 80s is when the internet really starts to come into its own. I mean, I feel the internet is the biggest thing since the invention of the printing press. And I feel that
it's big.
Yeah.
It's big.
So what effect has that had on this?
You know, I think it makes it much easier to segment your markets and to do tiering. I mean, just, you know, the speed at which you can gather data and, you know, things like when you call the bank or call the insurance company, they know what kind of customer you are. I mean, they know what your balance is. And if you're a high wealth, you know, high net worth individual, or you have, you know, a more elite account, you'll get service faster. And you can do all this kind of stuff. And even since the book came out, Disney, which I write about, you know, Walt Disney kind of envisioned everybody being the same in the park. You know, class differences were something that existed outside this fantasy land. And even since the book came out, Disney has moved in the direction of doing more kind of fast pass type, you know, segmentation, skipping the line. And it's very easy to do with apps and phones and technology and all that, much easier than when you were literally, you know, had two or three lines. It's you can camouflage, you know, people cutting much more easily with technology.
So we're talking about the book, The Velvet Rope Economy, How Inequality Became Big Business by Nelson D. Schwartz. So it seems that all the motivating factors are on the side of inequality. They're on the side of this kind of privilege. I know that, you know, being on the lower end of the privilege scale, I enjoy getting on the plane first. I enjoy being in first class, especially because I feel that flying has become so much worse for everybody than it used to be.
Yeah.
How do you motivate business without government becoming just obnoxiously powerful? How do you motivate business to bring us together?
I think there are social, you know, rituals which come into play and culture. And, you know, in certain parts of the country, you know, I think there's more of an ethic of everyone in it together and not being quite so separated. For example, in, you know, Minnesota and Wisconsin and, you know, those kind of states, there's, you know, more of this sense, maybe it's the Scandinavian roots of some of the society, but, you know, there's a sense of kind of equality, a sense of populism and equality. And, you know, the Green Bay Packers actually are fan owned they've sort of designed the stadium, but, you know, they have boxes and they have more elite areas, but, I mean, Scandinavia has a socialist tradition. That's why I mentioned it. So I'm not saying it's socialist in those part of the country, that part of the country. But in Green Bay, the stadium, when they remodeled it, they made sure that like a lot of the regular seats were good ones. And not, it wasn't such a kind of dystopian, you know, some people way up in the bleachers and some people enjoying over the top luxury boxes. So, and you know, that's, there are examples where the culture kind of influences things. I also think, you know, there's companies that have really emphasized more of an egalitarian kind of approach, like Southwest. Southwest doesn't have, you know, first class, and Southwest has done extremely well. I mean, it's one of the only airlines that never went bankrupt and has consistently made profits. So you can do well. I think the culture informs this as much as the government does.
During the Great Recession after 2008, a lot of these businesses, these incredibly big businesses, were bailed out by the government. Some of them were forced to be bailed out by the government to take government aid that they didn't necessarily want. And it seemed to me that the same people who might complain about the welfare state and people who are out of work getting government funds were actually taking government funds to keep these tremendous businesses alive. I can't help but feel that everything the government touches becomes more unequal. That, for instance, a television set, no, the government doesn't give you a television set. One day a TV comes out and it costs $10,000. The next year, that same TV costs $600. Is there some way that that the government has kind of fed inequality by, you know, by getting involved?
That's a tough one. I mean, I think I would say, you know, one issue is when the government intervenes in the market, you can get huge distortions. So let's say the government decided tomorrow to radically increase, you know, aid for education and college students. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised to see college tuition go up a lot, you know. So, I mean, I think that's the danger. And I think, you know, if we went to a nationalized healthcare service, you'd probably have even more demand for elite concierge care, you know. So, though, I mean, everything cuts both ways, I think, you know, when the government intervenes. Doesn't mean there's not a place for government, but I think that's a danger that sometimes people don't recognize when they're, you know, planning these kind of programs.
Yeah, good point. The Velvet Rope Economy, How Inequality Became Big Business by Nelson D. Schwartz, a really interesting subject and a very fair take on it. I really appreciate
Thank
your coming
you.
On. Yeah, no, it's nice talking to you. I hope you come back.
Great. Good luck. Please keep in touch and happy to come on anytime.
Thanks very much.